If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
You're listening to the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, Episode 29. Ivo Nuremberg has been working as a long-lens wildlife camera operator for over 20 years. He has a lifelong passion for wild places and has filmed in over 20 countries across the globe. From minus 40 degrees centigrade in Siberia and the high Canadian Arctic to plus 45 degrees centigrade in arid landscapes of India and Africa to the damp and humid tropical jungles of West Africa and South America. He specializes in long lens camera work, but also has experience with gyro-stabilized camera systems, thermal cameras, motion-controlled systems, sliders, remote cameras, and time-lapse, as well as multiple drones. He likes to build custom camera equipment to achieve unique perspectives and make the impossible pictures possible. Ivo was a producer and camera operator for Gulo Film Productions from 2004 to 2020. His films include The Lost Kings of Bioko, White Wolves, Ghosts of the Arctic, America's National Parks, Yellowstone, The Real Jungle Book Bear, Nordic Wild, Viking Wilderness, Wild Scandinavia, Wild Russia, Primeval Valleys, and Wolverine's Hyenas of the North. Ivo has also filmed sequences for multiple productions, including Russia in the Realm of Tigers, Bears, and Volcanoes, Frozen Planet, Monkey Kingdom, Dynasties 2, and Perfect Planet. Hi, Ivo. Thank you so much for taking the time out to be on the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast. Pleasure to have you here.
Yeah, thank you. It's really a pleasure and a big honor to be here.
So I want to start off, as always, Ivo, by just finding out a little bit about how you got into the filmmaking industry.
My dream to be a wildlife cameraman is since, I don't know, fifth class or so. Really, really early, I was already sure I want to become a wildlife filmmaker. Especially if we had one German wildlife filmmaker, kind of couple, other two men. And you could also see them in their films behind the camera. And that was always very funny. So you got a feeling how life can be in the field. So that was a very early thought that, okay, I want to do the same.
So how did you pursue that career, knowing that you wanted to be a wildlife camera person? How did you pursue that career from then on?
I started over 20 years in the business. And when I started, there was almost no internet, no email, no websites. It was really tricky. Finally, after school, I couldn't really find a way in wildlife film business. So I learned to be a commercial photographer. That was much easier. I thought at least this is something with cameras. And I did it for altogether 6 years. I worked at first as an assistant, then as a still photographer. And I always try to get one foot into wildlife film business. I made some phone calls, but they all said, oh, I don't need someone. And it was always no. And then after 4 years, I was a bit bored with photography, as especially with this commercial photography. So I started to traineeship in feature films. And So I did this for 2 years, and I was working as a second and first camera assistant for feature films. And because the one wildlife filmmaker, he said to me, okay, call me next year. And really, over 6 years, I called the same guy. And then really, after 6 years, said, yeah, I don't have a job, but I know a friend who needs one. So I called him, and then really I got an as assistant with Rudolf Lammers. I could go for ZDF to Namibia and work as an assistant for 6 weeks in the Etoshapan, and had my first experience.
It's amazing how perseverance and patience pays off in this industry. I mean, even when you're established, you still need to have perseverance and patience. And going right back to your beginning, it would have been so easy for you to have just thought, you know, nothing's going to come of it. You know, you contact people, they don't have anything for you. But waiting that time and then persevering, contacting them again, and being in a place where, you know, you're just plugging away at it because you know that's what you want to do. And it pays off. It pays off because, you know, although they didn't have a job for you, someone else did. And I think, you know, I tell everyone all the time, perseverance and patience, it's the key to this industry.
Yeah, this is really the key thing also later in work, kind of, never give up, always try and try and be persisting. That's really the key thing also. You have to believe in yourself, and you have to know what you want, and never give up.
So with that first job, did that open up any doors into the industry for you? What kind of happened next?
Yes, it opened more doors, but then it was still tricky because after the job, he said, oh, no, I don't need anyone anymore. And then I called the first wildlife filmmaker, I called him again. And then, was it a year later or so, he said, I still have no job for you, but again, I know another person who needs a cameraman. Well, they were, they had, too many jobs, and they urgently needed a cameraman for a film, and they just had no one available, so they had to kind of the cameraman, I met him, I told him a bit what I've done, showed him I already made a lot of wildlife pictures, stills. So at least I could show that I know something about wildlife. I know how to get close. I showed him some short films, but feature short films I made. So he knows, okay, I know some basic about filmmaking. And then he gave me his 100,000 euro film equipment, said, here, just shoot something for 1 weekend. Plus, I want to see if you can pan and frame and And yeah, so I took his, he just gave it to me. I mean, we never met before, just gave me his 100,000 euro camera kit. I was just filming some ducks and pigeons and whatever. He just wanted to, he says, yes, it doesn't matter what, just show me that you know how to use the camera. So I did it, he watched it, said, okay, well, that looks all fine. And then he sent me to 3 months to Norway. And I got my first chance to prove as a cameraman.
That's amazing that someone would just hand you all of their gear and to, you know, have you go off and see what you can do. It's incredible. You mentioned that you had been working in feature film. And I'm interested in how you feel that helped you with your craft, because I've done a lot of commercial work throughout my time behind a camera. And I tell people that it's, you know, if you're struggling to find work in the filmmaking industry, in the wildlife filmmaking industry, then it's far better to be using your camera and doing other work than it is to, say, go off and do another job entirely. Because it can just give you so much experience with your gear, learning to use your gear. So everything becomes intuitive. So when you're in front of wildlife and behaviors happening, you know where everything is, you know how to use that camera without having to stop and look for buttons and things like that. So for me, it feels very much worthwhile because you just get used to your gear, plus just learning composition, framing, simple things, interviewing, it can all help. So how did working in the feature film industry help with your craft?
Yeah, and both really definitely helped me in the future. In my still photography time, I definitely learned finally everything I have to know about colors, about framing, how to make a good looking picture. And in my feature film time, I learned something about how to build up a story. So both was very helpful, and all about wildlife, I just teach myself. And I was very early, I was in a conservation group. So with other young people, we tried to save birds and whatever, digging ponds for frogs and all this stuff. So I learned all about wildlife there and just reading books and try to teach myself everything about life. And of course, also watch every wildlife movie I could get.
And of course, it's so unbelievably important to research animal behavior, spend time around wildlife, like you said, being in conservation groups or, however it is, reading books, learning about the wildlife. It's more important than the camera angle, learning your camera gear. I tell people all the time, if you can learn about animal behavior and then pick up a camera, you'll pick up how to use a camera in your gear so much more quickly than you will learning about wildlife behavior. And you can see that with your film White Wolves, obviously integrating yourselves with that pack of wolves like you did. You can see that you obviously, you understand behavior to be that close to them in the first place.
Yeah, the behavior, watching behavior is really critical. No, we have been made 3 trips altogether, 5 months with the wolves in the Arctic, and really, watching carefully the behavior, this crucial thing. And you are learning every day. You are learning more and more, and I mean, of course, all animals kind of basically behave the same, but again, there of course, with every species, there are differences, especially at the wolf pack. Every individual of a wolf pack behaves different, has his own character, and it was so interesting to learn about the different characters in the wolf pack. It was really other friendly, because especially as the wolves in the Arctic, they have almost they are almost not shy of humans, so you can really sit there openly. Of course, from a distance still, but watch the behavior was really definitely my most special time with wildlife. Yeah, have been the wolves.
And it looked like an incredible experience. I mean, you can tell just watching White Wolves that, how close you were to that pack. And then, of course, there's the behind the scenes that show how close and integrated you were with that pack. And it brings up the question, what would you say throughout your career has been the most incredible experience that you've had?
It is still my very, very first own film I made with Oliver Goetze. It is, we made a film about wolverines. And because it's kind of a little bit sad story. As I told you, I got this first chance as a cameraman and worked in Norway. And then we got another job. And unfortunately, he got very, very ill. And finally, he died on cancer. This really nice man. And so then at this point, I was standing there, and the only man who gave me a job was dying. I was still kind of a nobody in the business. And then, what to do? And then, my ex-film partner, Oliver V, we thought, hey, but we want to make. He was assisting me on the first job, and then now we have to make our own film. So then we were looking for a topic, and we found this story about a crazy Finnish wildlife still photographer working for many years almost just with wolverines. And we wrote to him and then said, yeah. She said, okay, we work together. And when we approached NDR, and at that time, I mean, it's kind of impossible to film wolverines, yeah, as the only, yeah. And finally we got the job. Later on, the chief editor, he told us that he asked some well-known wildlife filmmakers, is it possible to make a film about Wolverine? They all said, no, it's not impossible, and we would never do it. But he still gave this two newcomer a job. We bought, that was the first time we had to shoot in HD at that time. Yeah, so we bought film equipment and we just had a try, had a go. And wolverines are still super fantastic animals. They are very, very special character. They look amazing. Yeah, and really, really fascinating. So this is still, and very, very funny, because on this Norway shoot where I worked first, now we were filming a musk ox with some cubs, and suddenly a wolverine was coming running over a hill, running through kind of in the middle through the musk ox herd. And yeah, I said, hey, there's a wolverine. Someday we have to make a film about wolverines. And then finally, we got the newcomer award in Jackson Hole for the wolverine film, nominated on widescreen with the first film. So this was really, that really opened doors.
I mean, that's incredible. Your first film that you actually took on yourself to make, and you won Newcomer Award, which in itself is incredible. But not just that, the fact that you were filming wolverines, which have to be one of the hardest animals to find, let alone film. So, how did you do that with your first film? How did you locate wolverines well enough to make an entire show about them?
We went to Finland. We met this guy. He set us in his hide. First day we saw wolverine. He was working with two families, or two females, and he knew his wolverine so good. He knows the banana. Yeah, for him it was, yeah.
And I know, filming that type of wildlife, it's almost impossible to film all of the aspects of a story actually being there and filming from your tripod. So I'm assuming you used remote cameras for this. And I know I've read that you do a lot with your camera gear. You customize a lot of your gear. So, what kinds of things do you find that you have to do to be able to get the shots? I know, I use A7Ss a lot, low light cameras, build camera traps with them. The biggest problem I find is with remote cameras, most of the time you're either leaving them running and you're not far away, so you can control them. But one of the biggest problems with that is that there's really nothing made that gives you any kind of long range to be able to operate the camera from a distance. Or there are things like camtraptions, which you can put out there and they're triggered as an animal goes by. But tell us a little bit about some of the customizations of your rigs that you've had to do to get the shots that you've managed to get.
Yeah, I really almost customize everything. I'm never really 100% happy with the gear you can buy. So really everything. The one thing is I'm building remote cameras. You can remote control from some distance with panning, video, zoom, record, everything. But for example, I'm forever was building on my panning head for the big lenses, the zoom demand. I changed the switches. I made the grip, that it has more grip, or changed screws that they work more nicely, or changed cables who are more flexible in cold conditions, or I change the eyepiece, or it's tried to get something lighter. I was building my own matte box, which is much lighter than everyone you can buy. Or I was developing a camera bag over many, many years, many versions. Now I have really some colleagues now who said, oh, I want to have the same camera bag. So I already sold a few of these camera bags, because the problem is you can't buy a camera bag which is big enough for our big camera setups. They are made for normal small cameras. So there is no weatherproof camera bag where you can fit in an Arri camera with a CN20. You just can't buy one. I really often tiny things, or I was building a little joystick remote for my Arri camera, so I can, with my left focus hand, I have a little joystick, and with a joystick I can switch assign buttons from the camera, which is fantastic, because I can switch my camera speed with one finger without moving my hands somewhere. No, I often change speed a lot, shoot it with 30, 28, 40 frames, whatever, and it's convenient.
Is it camera specific? So are you building the remote camera systems for a specific camera, or is it something that you can use on any type of camera?
It's not depending on the camera. It is just working with a Sony Lung protocol. So it is working within Zcam, but also working within FX6 or whatever. So I'm a bit flexible, but it's very difficult to build a reliable remote. No, of course, the cameras nowadays, they all have Wi-Fi control, but they work in an open environment for 20 meters, which is not long enough. It has to work on 100 meters, and then 100 meters in a forest, or the camera is in a cave or something. No one of the normal remote systems work really in the forest. In the beginning I was buying ready-made, but they were all not reliable enough.
Now that customization brings us on perfectly to this next question about the CN20 lens. Now, this is, I find a remarkable story that you basically, I don't want to tell the story, I'll let you do that, but basically, there was a gap in the market, if you like, for a lens that would do what wildlife photographers and videographers rather needed to be able to capture behavior from a distance. And so you had an idea in your head, and you approached manufacturers to get the CN20, the 50 to 1000 millimeter Canon wildlife filmmaking lens made. Can you tell us a little about it? Because there's really nothing else like it, right? It is the go-to lens because it has that range from 50 to 1,000 millimeter. Can you just tell us how the whole thing came about how you got Canon to actually produce this lens?
Yeah. I mean, we worked with 2/3-inch cameras, and of course you had already these 36 42 times lenses, but then Arri came up with the first Alexa camera, and then with the Red One at the same time, and of course the dynamic range was so much better than with all these 2/3-inch cameras. So at some point I said, we have to work with these cameras. The image just is like, it is cinema, and it's not TV anymore. But of course, there was this big lens problem. IBE was building this adapter. So at first we started to work with the two set inch lenses adapted to the Arri Alexa camera. But of course, it's not satisfying. You're losing quality, you're losing light. That definitely made me not happy. And I was already working with Arri. So beta testing for them, working on the software. So I already had some experience with working together with companies. But it's something else to approach a Japanese company. They are a bit more secret. They are a bit different. I contacted the kind of German product manager and told him that we need a proper wildlife film lens for super 35, and he said, yeah, that sounds interesting. I will speak to my colleague. And funny enough, he said, I can arrange a contact, and then we meet in Amsterdam, on the big fair, I had a meeting with the European head product manager from Canon, and I told him that we need a long lens. I said, yeah, interesting. And then he just said, yeah, let's be in contact. Also, let's stay in contact. And then I had feeling, okay, maybe it's worth to dig a bit deeper into it. And then I really made research. I was really thinking about it a lot. And I was also contacting a lot of colleagues, Germany, but also a lot of BBC colleagues. I just sent them emails and just asked them, hey, what do you need? Whatever, Gavin Thurston or whoever. Just wrote him. I didn't know him. I just know he is famous. And just wrote him an email and a lot of other, Barry Britton, and asked them, hey, What is important for you? What do you think is a good focal length? Weight. And so I was really asked the other 10, 15 colleagues. And I was really thinking, what do you need? And what it was, I think the key thing, I try to be realistic with my wishes, because of course, if you ask someone, they all say, oh, make it from wide angle to the super tele and super light, but super light sensitive, but no weight. And of course, you can't build a lens. And then it has to be very, very cheap. So, and I really tried to be realistic. And I was, I also, then I wrote down my specs, and I was very, very precise. The zoom range, the lens diameter, the length of the lens itself, the weight, the light, the f-stop, every ring has to, where the focus ring has to be. And I really described the lens very precise. And then he said, oh, yeah, that's interesting. And then the Hank was it at that time. Then he flew, he was based in London. And then he flew to Hamburg to meet me. We had dinner together. I told him everything. I said, I will speak to my boss in Japan. And then he spoke to him. Then we were discussing a bit. I changed some parameters a few times on the specs, and they said, my boss wants to meet you. Yeah, and then 1 year later, I had a meeting with the big bosses from Canon CineLens, Broadcast Lens. So I was really meeting the boss of the whole Cine Broadcast Lens. And some other guys. I was meeting some lens designer and the designer for the housing, and we discussed about my specs. And nice man. In the evening, we had dinner together. Went to a strange beer house, and it was really nice. And it was really a personal relationship started. It was really a good time. So we were every now and then changed emails, had a phone call, discussed, and then I think it was another year later, again in Amsterdam, they presented me the lens, the first prototype of it.
I mean, it's amazing that you were able to get such a large manufacturer to take note that there was a need for this, especially as they're extremely expensive. I mean, that's $70,000 to buy. So it's not like there's a massive market for these, but for them to take note enough to say, hey, there is this gap in the market. You guys need them as wildlife cinematographers. It's incredible that, that it came about. So was it as simple as them being able just to build it to your spec, or were there issues along the way? I mean, did they ever come back to you and say, no, we can't do this, no, we can't do that, it's going to have to be this, not that? Or was it just simply a case that they could do it?
Yeah, and really on the way, coming there, they asked me, I think, a few times, is 4K quality really important? Because they said, hey, we are struggling to build this lens, wouldn't it be enough to just have 2K quality? And I said to them, no, just I said to them, we need 4K quality, just try harder. And then as I just says, we can't accept, and I also one the other thing I said, the lens has to be short, what was also a very tricky part for them. Other thing, the 4K quality, the zoom range, and this short lens was really tricky for them. And afterwards, they said this was the most tricky, complicated lens they have ever built.
And of course, now it is the most widely used wildlife filmmaker's lens. I mean, if you look at any of the behind the scenes of any of the big blue chip landmark series, you'll see a CN20 attached to any of the cameras out there filming that footage. So, it's an incredible lens. And not only because it's a 50 to 1,000 millimeter, but I believe it also has an extender on there built into it. So you can extend it two times or something like that. So it's, it has really opened up the world for us filmmakers today to be able to have a lens like that to use with these incredible cameras today.
Yeah, I have to say what you just mentioned, the extender. At this time, every broadcast lens had a two-time extender. And I was the first, I said, hey, every two-time extender I have ever seen, I was not happy with the quality. So if it's maybe physically, technically not possible to build a good two-time extender, build a 1.5. And this was really something unique at that time, to have a 1.5 extender in a lens. So that was also something that really never happened before. On the other hand, of course, finally, the lens does the same what we had earlier with the 2/3, big zoom lenses. It's not really that there is something new. It's just we have our old convertible zoom lenses back from the 2/3 inch cameras. But what is amazing, and the lens is not so much bigger than these old 42 time lenses. But it is much more heavy. It's unfortunately, what is also interesting, they really fulfilled 90% of my wishes, what I have never expected. And really, my lengths, my diameters, it was really almost on the millimeter exactly what I told them. What was really cool. The only thing they had to make the lens half an f-stop darker than I want, but it was just technically not possible. Also physically, if you have this front diameter and this focal length, there are limits. So it became a little bit more heavy. So the lens without the motor has the weight I wanted, but of course you need a zoom motor. What was also funny, they had the kind of project code name later on was the Evosun lens. What was very funny, they told me one day that internally at Canon they didn't speak about the CN20, they told about the Evosun lens. What I found very nice.
They so should have kept it called the Evosun lens. That would have been fantastic. So much better than the CN20. So obviously you own one of these lenses and you've been using it for a long, long time. How does it live up to your expectations of the lens? I mean, most lenses, whether they're stills or cinematography lenses, have sweet spots. They've got those areas that you find in them that are super crisp, much nicer. They've got some soft spots. How does this lens compare? Is it super crisp all the way through, or does it have its limitations?
I am very, very happy with the lens, and it's definitely an improvement to the Fuji non-Canon 36-42 lenses. But of course, there are some weak spots in the zoom range, of course. But you can live with it. You just know, okay, if I have really hard backlight, then I try to avoid maybe certain focal lengths. But altogether, I'm really happy from the very long end to the wide open. Altogether, I'm really happy also in harsh backlight. It performs really very well. But of course, there are limits. I mean, it's just in CN20 and with 9 kilograms, I think. Of course, I spoke to them. But that's okay. If we really make it better, then it would be much bigger, because the diameter has to be much bigger and therefore much more heavy. So for the weight, for the size, I'm really, really happy with the lens.
And of course, every bit of kit has its limitations one way or another. But, just an incredible story that you were able to get Canon to make this lens. It's amazing. So let's move on to some of your recent projects. Now, I know you filmed recently for the episode The Sun on Perfect Planet. Can you tell us a little bit about what you were filming for that episode?
I was working on the snow geese polar fox sequence. So I was for 6 weeks in the high Arctic, in really nowhere in northern Canada, I think it's the biggest snow geese colony in the whole world. I think it's about 1 million snow geese in 50 kilometers. It's an amazing place. You have to be dropped by a helicopter, and then he picks you up 6 weeks later. And what is amazing, I mean, snow geese are, I like them a lot. And of course, I mean, everyone like polar foxes. They look so nice, and they are not too shy of humans. And it is one of the last wilderness on Earth. I love this feeling. You are out there, you are looking 360, and you see just wild, as it just nature. There's no house, no power line, or no whatever. No tower, nothing, no car, no road. And you can walk for a week straight, and you will still not meet any road or whatever. It's just wilderness. And this is what I really like, and why I'm want to be a wildlife filmmaker, to be in this wide places.
Yeah, it's an incredible experience being in those polar regions where, as you say, you can just see for miles. And I found the time that I spent in, near the Arctic, One of the biggest things that was really noticeable, other than the fact that there's, you know, you can see for miles, is also the sound, how quiet it is, because there's literally, you're getting no noise from any city nearby or traffic or planes. It's almost like dead airspace. And I found that incredible when I was out there. But also just, you know, it is the fact it's not for everyone. I mean, it is highly remote. So you've got to be able to enjoy that kind of place to spend any time out there.
I mean, if you were in a snow geese colony, you will always hear snow geese day and night. There's only a very short time between 11 p.m. and 3 a.m. in the morning where it's a bit more silent. All the time, there is this blah, 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 blah. But I like it a lot. Of course, life is simple. No? Of course, you have no hotel there. No? It's no sleeping bags. No, you have very simple wooden little cabin with no heating in the bedroom or so. Of course, it's simple life, but I like it.
And I know one of the creatures you spent a lot of time filming also are Arctic foxes in those polar regions. And you've filmed some amazing shots of them jumping and nosediving into the snow to get their quarry. How long does it take you to get that kind of behavior on camera? I mean, are you literally following them and sitting with them for days? Because they're obviously not doing that all the time. They're just feeding at certain times. And then once you do film them, you know, jumping in the air and head diving into the snow, are they catching their food every time? Are they getting their prey every time they go down? Or is it not that simple?
I filmed it for the wolf film, but we started in early June. There is still a little snow cover still in early June in the Arctic, but not enough. No? So... we have never seen this. But I filmed it in Yellowstone with red foxes and on Ellesmere with the polar foxes. My feeling is they get one out of three, maybe they catch one. They are really good. I mean, the problem in the winter time is to follow them. No? When snow is so deep and you have snowshoes or a skidoo and they are fast. No? They are traveling really fast in winter or in summer. Either way, they are traveling fast. And to follow them in winter is really difficult. So it's more the problem to be close enough when they do a jump. And to be, following them and to have the camera ready, no? This is two different things. So this is, always, no? To be at the right time, at the right spot. That's the thing.
Of course. And that's one of the things about wildlife filmmaking, right? Being in the right place at the right time. It's essential most of the time. Now, if you had one piece of advice to offer up to aspiring wildlife filmmakers, or more than one piece of advice, if you like, what would that be?
Definitely more than one. No, man, you have to be a multi-talent. So it is very good to have some backcountry backpacking experience. So you are familiar with being outdoors. It's definitely important to be happy in every weather condition outside. Because if you are outside, you can be sure you are sweating, you are freezing, there are mosquitoes biting you, ants biting you, leeches wanting your blood or whatever. There's always something. It's never perfect. It's always too hot or too cold or too itchy or too sweaty or something. So you have to be really relaxed with every situation out there. If you are not happy with whatever will come to you, of course, I get also emails and phone calls and some dream only of this in Africa, going around with a car and easy life. There are also jobs like this, but for sure not every job is like this. So this is very important. Going out, get experience with watch wildlife, See if you are happy to sit there for hours and watching wildlife. That's important. Take a camera. Doesn't have to be a good camera, just any little camera with a bit longer lens, and just try to get some footage. It doesn't have to be a shy, rare animal. Just get some feeling for cameras. I also find it good for learning really to watch good Hollywood movies. I think I learned a lot about panning and camera movements or watching good Hollywood cinema movies. And of course, not to forget, you have to carry an 25-30 kilograms backpack for many kilometers, off-road, mountains, wherever. You have to be able to carry gear. And the other thing is really to have an open eye. This is what I really worked as a camera assistant in feature film. They really told me to be a good assistant. Don't wait until someone is asking you to do something, because then you are late. Always try to anticipate what does the cameraman needs next. It's kind of the same with animal behavior. You always have to say, okay, what will my animal I'm filming, what will it do next? Will it going left or right? Will it jump now, or will it just sleep? It's always about anticipating what is coming next. It's wildlife filming, it's with penning, it's with following animals, and it's also with helping maybe the cameraman. Always try to think, okay, where can I make help? Where does he need a hand? Maybe batteries have to be charged, or what else can be done for the next shooting day. Use your head, use your eyes.
So what's next for you, Ivo? I know this has been an incredibly trying year for everybody, in the wildlife filmmaking industry, and really in every industry, things have been cancelled and put on hold. How has it affected you? Where do you head next?
I should go to China in April, but unfortunately we don't get a visa for China. So it looks, if I go to Switzerland, that seems to be easier. I just got 10 minutes ago, I got another email asking me if I can go to Namibia, maybe. I have another shoot also waiting for visa. There is some work waiting for me, but it's all depending on entry visa in the moment. It's definitely the most tricky time I have ever been in. But this is COVID. That's a pandemic. That's something else than normal problems.
So, Ivo, where can people find you if they want to follow what you're doing, see the films that you've made, and just find the information about where you are and what you're up to? Where can they find you online?
Yes, I just deleted my Facebook account a week ago. I was really fed up with too many commercials, advertisement all over the place, and to say the truth, the people share too much unimportant stuff on Facebook. It's just, you have to go to too much ways to find the useful information. But I am on Instagram still, so you can follow me on Instagram, and I also have my own webpage, ivowildlife.com. So just my first name, wildlife in one word, .com. So you can, and there's also a button to my Instagram account. And you can see, and there are a lot of nice pictures, also behind the scenes pictures, so you can see something when I'm on work.
I've just realized, is your name pronounced Ivo or Evo? Because I realized that I've been saying Ivo all the way through this interview, and you've just said Evo.
Yeah, of course. That's, of course, very common. I mean, I work nowadays mostly for Netflix and BBC. And, of course, in English, you pronounce an E like an I and an I like an E. In German, or it's the other way around. But originally it is pronounced Evo.
Well, sorry for that. And thank you, Evo, for spending the time on the podcast today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much that I had the opportunity to talk to you.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, then please leave a rating and a comment. And remember to subscribe to keep up to date with the series' future episodes. You can find out more information about wildlife filming at jakewillers.com. And if you're interested in starting a career in the wildlife filmmaking industry or being mentored to further your career, then please visit jakewillers.com/mentorship. Thanks for listening.